This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on African News Tonight.
Some people who support Gachagua say that this is basically, you know, just trying to get rid of him. It's a political lynching, basically, you know, accusing either the president and his supporters to be trying to get rid of him.
That's VOA's Nairobi Bureau Chief Mariama Diallo on the just-launched impeachment trial of Kenya's Deputy President Rigathi Gachagua. Details coming up. Also, as we mark World Food Day today, the UN says hunger persists for 10% of the planet's population. And police say more than 90 people have been killed after a gasoline tanker overturned in Nigeria and sparked an explosion. These stories and more on African News Tonight. But first, our top story. Kenya's Senate today launched the impeachment trial of Deputy President Rigathi Gachagua after the embattled politician lost yet another court bid to stop the process. Gachagua, a powerful businessman from Kenya's biggest tribe, Kikuyu, weathered previous corruption scandals to become deputy leader as President William Ruto's running mate in a closely fought election in August 2022. But in recent weeks, he has complained of being sidelined by the president and has been accused of supporting youth-led anti-government protests that broke out in June. For more on today's impeachment proceedings, I talked to our Nairobi Bureau Chief Mariama Diallo, who is closely monitoring the situation.
Thank you for having me. Basically, to go back a little bit, last week, Kenya's National Assembly actually voted to basically impeach the country's deputy president, Rigathi Gachagua, over, you know, 11 counts. And those 11 counts of accusations include corruption, abuse of office, and all kinds of other stuff. So that was last week. So basically, what's happening today is that the motion was moved to the Senate. So they are having the hearing, proceeding hearings today at the Senate. And in fact, as we are speaking, the council, you know, on both sides, meaning the council for the National Assembly, was told that they had 30 minutes to kind of make their opening statement, and they just finished. I think that was led by Honorable Orango, who started by saying literally that impeachment is not new to the Senate, but this is new. This is the first time in the history of Kenya that they are actually trying to remove a DP by impeachment.
And Mariama, does this case highlight the friction between Gachagua and President William Ruto? Gachagua believes the impeachment process has Ruto's blessing.
Well, I think the friction could be starting even back from during the Gen Z's protest. I remember at the time when President Ruto will come out and say something, DP Gachagua will come out on the other side and say something. It, you know, literally the two of them seemed very disconnected. Yeah, some people who support Gachagua say that this is basically, you know, just trying to get rid of him. It's a political lynching, basically, you know, accusing either the president and his supporters to be trying to get rid of him. At the same time, the Senate and Parliament are saying that, you know, they are making their cases, that their case that there are actually 11 counts, as I said, including undermining the government and insubordination, like gross misconduct. So they have a list of charges that they are accusing him of. I also have to say that DP Gachagua actually yesterday tried to stop the Senate proceedings by filing a motion at the High Court to see if they can stop the Senate proceedings. He was unsuccessful. He also asked for a 3-judge bench to be appointed, and that also fell through today.
And as far as you are concerned, Mariama, has President Ruto given any public comment on this impeachment process?
I haven't seen it yet. It could be out there, but I haven't seen it. And if he does make a statement or any have any kind of opinion on the process, we'll make sure to bring it to you.
And lastly, Mariama, do you think these tensions with the impeachment risk introducing more uncertainty for investors and others in this East Africa's commercial hub?
Well, I guess that's a great question, because some of the arguments that people who are supporting the DP's side are talking about that this is kind of a distraction, that Kenya has gone through a lot of issues recently, you know, the huge protests about the proposed tax increases, the high cost of living, about 50 people who have died during these protests. So people who support DP Gachagua are talking about the fact that this is a distraction, that Kenya really has so many other things to concentrate on instead of, you know, spending a week or 2 weeks doing trials like this, a trial basically against one person. So that's basically the argument that some of the people on Mr. Gachagua's side are saying. But, I mean, I guess the people who also are talking about good governance and who feel that, you know, maybe the institutions are not being respected the way a deputy president should respect those kinds of rules. They are the ones also who are making the arguments and listing their charges, taking it all the way to the Senate and hoping to remove, you know, an official like DP Gachagua.
VOA's Nairobi Bureau Chief, Mariama Diallo, she spoke with me from Nairobi. The United Nations says there is enough food in the world, but hunger persists for 10% of the planet's population. James Shimanyula reports from Nairobi on World Food Day.
The 2024 Global Hunger Index shows that hunger levels are alarming in six African countries: South Sudan, Burundi, Chad, Madagascar, Somalia, and Yemen. In South Sudan, Africa's newest nation, two-thirds of the 11 million people need humanitarian assistance. Bernard Owade is the World Food Programme's lead food security analyst in South Sudan.
South Sudan is facing serious food insecurity. According to the latest food insecurity phase classification, almost 7.8 million people are food insecure, facing worse effects of hunger, and therefore require urgent humanitarian support. This is the highest number globally. We're basically talking of more than 60% of the population being in their need of humanitarian support.
Owade says South Sudan faces several challenges in producing and supplying food.
South Sudan is prone to drought and flooding and has been flooded for the last 4 years. The current conflicts that continue to impact on the population of this country, frequent conflicts, some are ethnic, the difficult economic environment. We have IDPs in camps, we have refugees in camps, largely depends on humanitarian support for their survival.
The United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization says 150 countries will observe World Food Day on October 16th to generate awareness about hunger and to encourage actions to ensure food security for all. The latest data on world hunger by the Global Hunger Index, which measures the severity of various hunger indicators, shows the world produces enough food to feed all of its 8 billion people, yet 733 million people go hungry every day. The index indicates hunger rates in Africa are especially high, with 1 out of 5 people going hungry each day. The Integrated Food Phase Classification estimates 1.33 million people around the world are experiencing famine or famine-like conditions. Hundreds of thousands of them are in Sudan, where an 18-month-long war has blocked food supplies to parts of the Darfur region. The WFP also has reported alarming levels of hunger in Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo, where conflict has driven hundreds of thousands of people from their homes, and the drought has led to increasing hunger in parts of Southern Africa, particularly Malawi, Zambia, and Zimbabwe. For VOA Africa, I am James Shimanyula in Nairobi.
Police say more than 90 people have been killed and 50 others injured after a gasoline tanker overturned in Nigeria and sparked an explosion as dozens of people rushed to the vehicle to scoop up the fuel. The Associated Press reports the explosion occurred past midnight in Jigawa State after the tanker driver lost control on a highway close to a university. Deadly tanker accidents are common in Nigeria, where traffic regulations are not strictly enforced in many places, and there is a lack of alternatives, such as an efficient railway system, to transport cargo. You're listening to African News Tonight on The Voice of America. Find us on voaafrica.com. There you'll find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. And of course, we'd love to hear from you. You can share your thoughts about the news and our programs by WhatsApp. The number is +1 202 258 3076. Every Wednesday, we'll be sharing our listeners' comments on African News Tonight. The war in Sudan has escalated in recent weeks as the National Army has deployed its superior air power to help it regain some territory in and around the capital Khartoum and to pound other areas occupied by the rival Rapid Support Forces. Mohamed Dagalo, the commander of the RSF, has accused Egypt of helping the Sudanese army. Angie Omar has more from Cairo.
In a video message, the head of the Rapid Support Forces paramilitary group, Mohamed Dagalo, said the Egyptian military has conducted air strikes against RSF troops. In the video, Dagalo expressed condolences for RSF soldiers he described as treacherously murdered by Egyptian aircraft, suggesting a deliberate campaign against his forces. Dagalo gives a special greeting to those he called the heroes of the Battle of Mount Moya. He says the conflict resembles the Battle of Karbala, targeting unarmed civilians heading to Saudi Arabia, which he says also was struck by the Egyptian Air Force. He says the RSF remained silent for a long time, hoping that those responsible would wake up and retreat. Unfortunately, he says the Egyptians are persistent, and now they have entered the battle. Dagalo alleges that Egypt is not only conducting airstrikes, but also the Islamic State, IS, is training and equipping the Sudanese armed forces with drones and U.S.-made weapons. Washington has repeatedly called for a ceasefire in Sudan and has tried to get the two sides to negotiate. The Egyptian Ministry of Foreign Affairs dismissed Dagalo's claims, saying that Egypt is committed to halting the war and protecting civilians. The ministry called for the international community to examine any evidence that supports Dagalo's assertions, which Egypt called unfounded. However, Egypt has historically enjoyed a close relationship with the Sudanese military, led by Army Chief Abdel Fattah al-Burhan. Former Egyptian Army General Mohammed Abdel Wahed explains what may be behind RSF claims. General Abdel Wahed says Dagalo's statements have no basis in truth, and this is not the first time he accused other countries of aiding the Sudanese army. He says Dagalo has made such claims multiple times since the war started in April 2023. Abdel Wahed says whenever the Rapid Support Forces face setbacks, Dagalo accuses other countries of supporting the Sudanese army or even spreads rumors to create divisions within the Sudanese army itself. The United States has recently imposed sanctions on individuals associated with the RSF to curtail their ability to procure weapons and support its military operations. One of those sanctioned was senior RSF leader Al-Ghani Hamdan Dagalo Moussa, the younger brother of the RSF commander. Joseph Siegel leads the Africa Center for Strategic Studies Research in Washington. He says Al-Ghani Dagalo also has made accusations that Egypt provided the Sudanese army with U.S.-made weapons. He says, however, the allegations seem like an effort to distract from his own role.
And Al-Ghani's role as a key procurement leader is in direct violation of the UN Security Council resolution prohibiting the arming of any faction in Sudan. His actions and the actions of the RSF have directly contributed to the RSF's Arab militias' ethnic cleansing that's taking place in the Darfur region against African communities from that part of Western Sudan. This includes the ongoing siege of El Fasher, and a city that's been under siege, with estimates that some 75,000 people are currently facing famine.
The civil war in Sudan, which erupted in April 2023, following a failed transition to a civilian rule, is one of the world's largest humanitarian catastrophes. Over 10 million people have been displaced, and the country faces widespread severe hunger and disease. The United Nations has warned of famine in parts of Darfur. This is Angie Omar, reporting for VOA News from Cairo.
Chad is pleading for urgent international assistance for more than 2 million people affected by floods that have killed at least 600 people. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from neighboring Cameroon, where some Chadian civilians are rushing for safety.
Chadian cattle rancher Abdurrahman Abu tells Cameroon officials in Kuseri that he lost all of his livestock in floods that are sweeping through his country. Abdurrahman says floods carried away his house at Digangali village near Chad's capital N'Djamena on Monday, and he doesn't know where his wife and five children are. The town of Kuseri is on Cameroon's northern border with Chad. Cameroon officials say Abdurrahman is one among close to 700 civilians who this week sought refuge in Kuseri and neighboring border villages after weeks of flooding. Farmer Maloni Dziano says he fled from N'Djamena to Kuseri this week. Dziano says his rice plantation is in ruins after heavy rains unleashed flooding that also destroyed buildings and public structures in N'Djamena this week. He says his family of three has had no food to eat since they left N'Djamena on Sunday. Dziano says his family and other flood victims hope the governments of Chad and Cameroon and donors would help them with food, water, and shelter. The Cameroon government says some of the flood victims from Chad are living with relatives in Cameroon, while others are in mosques, schools, and churches. Chad's government says more than 600 civilians have been killed and about 250,000 homes washed away by floods that became severe in August and may continue into November. At least 450,000 hectares of land and several hundred farms and plantations have been flooded, and more than 1 million cattle, goats, and sheep are either dead or missing. Chad's Prime Minister Alamaye Halina visited flood victims in N'Djamena over the past week. He spoke on Chad State TV on Tuesday. He says he wants to assure citizens that Chad's government, under the leadership of President Mohamed Idriss Déby, is very concerned about the floods, which are the most destructive in the country's history. He says Déby has ordered all district councils to provide victims with the necessary health and humanitarian care while waiting for more assistance from the international community. Chadian authorities say many communities face severe hunger and about 2 million people need humanitarian assistance. Many families in Chad are seeking shelter at makeshift sites and schools. The government says hundreds do not have access to hospitals, clean drinking water, sanitation and hygiene. Officials say hospitals are crowded with wounded patients and malnourished children, and diseases such as diarrhea, malaria and skin infections may spike. Last week, Cameroon reported about 70,000 civilians fled into Chad to escape floods along the border. Unusually heavy rains have battered parts of Chad, Cameroon and Nigeria for weeks. For VOA News, I am Moki Edwin Kinzika in Yaoundé, Cameroon.
In the United States, all eyes are on the seven so-called battleground states that are expected to determine the outcome of the 2024 presidential election between Vice President Kamala Harris and former President Donald Trump. While some of them have shifted politically over the years, the western swing state of Nevada does not lean strongly towards one major party or the other. VOA's Dora Mahakwa reports from Las Vegas.
Nevada, home to 3.1 million people, is probably best known for Las Vegas, its most famous city, also known as Sin City. Tom Riley is a professor and expert on democracy and citizenship at Arizona State University.
But they're a bit of a paradox. I mean, they're seen as perhaps a liberal state in some sense because it was the first state that really pushed no-fault divorce. It has gambling in certain counties. It allows prostitution. But it also has this undercurrent of being very, very conservative in some respects.
Nevada reliably voted Republican from the late 1960s until the early 2000s. Since then, the state regularly swings between the two political parties. Nevada's population has more than tripled since 1980. Many recent newcomers are from predominantly liberal California. Ken Miller is an assistant professor of political science at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas.
What's happened is the Clark County, which is the county where Las Vegas sits, is now 72% of the voting population in this state. So what has happened to Nevada is what was once a rural Mountain West state has become an urban West Coast state.
Nevada college student David Cardenas has noticed the state's political split.
There's Vegas, and then there's the rest of Nevada. And from my knowledge, Vegas tends to be more on the Democrat side, whereas the rest of Nevada is more Republican. But then again, most of the population is in Vegas.
Despite the population explosion, Nevada remains heavily working class, with many residents working manual jobs, says UNLV's Miller.
So things like wages, things like unemployment, things like housing affordability, just inflation in general, so things like fuel prices, all of those things affect people a little bit more here in Nevada than they might some other states.
College students at the University of Nevada at Las Vegas outline their top issues. Some will vote for the first time now that they've reached the voting age of 18.
Definitely abortion, definitely the economy, education as well.
The state of the economy, probably just the border. I'm kind of broke college kid. I would just like to be able to better afford food. I would like to be able to have a single job that pays enough to help me with all of my needs.
When they vote in November's general election, Nevadans will also vote on whether to install a right to abortion in the state constitution. Rebecca Gill is director of the Women's Research Institute of Nevada.
The issue overall has already proven to be a big driver, a big motivator of turnout in prior elections, and I think this one will be no different.
Still, Miller says no one should underestimate former President Donald Trump's chances of winning Nevada.
I think that Trump is being perceived as a candidate unlikely to win Nevada simply because he hasn't won the last two times. I wouldn't discount the importance of economic issues as driving the decision for voters in this state.
Nevada's critical role as a battleground state is why both presidential nominees, Trump and Vice President Kamala Harris, are spending time here. Because ultimately, what happens in Vegas could determine who will lead America for the next 4 years. Dora McQuarrie, VOA News, Las Vegas.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiya Suhib in Washington. On behalf of our producer David Van Dee and our engineer Shogun Chung, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.